We have a lot of material to cover today, and I want to save a good portion of the time for discussion. I'd like to start with something that we've... Go ahead and begin the tape. My name is Jim Lundy. I've met many of you. I want to start with a little model that we've used in some other discussions because it's very, very important when we talk about emotions that we get clear in our mind that emotions, first of all, in terms of thoughts, in terms of human awareness, thoughts and feelings are what we're primarily aware of, as well as bodily sensations, okay? But we're pretty much leaving bodily sensations out because that's more of a physical concept. Your thoughts are about 20% of the motivational power in your life, and your feelings are about 80%. But it's important to realize that human awareness is influenced simultaneously by four factors. And some of you have heard this enough times, I'm going to go over it fairly quickly. But it's influenced by your genetics and your biology. Anger can be produced by physiological processes, not psychological ones. And we need to be aware of that. All emotions can be produced by biochemical processes. Also, our emotions are influenced by our spiritual values, by our psychology and our learning history, and by our culture or our environment. Every one of us, at every point in time, has an awareness of thoughts, feelings, and sensations that's simultaneously made up of these four components. And they are mixed together like a stew. And it's our job together, as we learn about ourselves, each one of us, to figure out what's going on here. Today, when we look at anger, a very complex emotion, we're looking at all of these factors at the same time. Now, we're talking about embracing split-off parts of ourselves. And what we mean by that is parts of our feelings that exist, but that have gotten put over in a place where we don't pay too much attention to it. And so let's start by thinking about anger just a bit, and I wanted to read to you at least one passage from the life of Jesus where he was angry, and angry in a good way, so that we can be on the same wavelength and starting out that anger is a good emotion, can be. Another time he went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with a shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked him, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger, and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. There's an example of Jesus angry as he's interacting with this man with a shriveled hand, wanting to bring his healing and some of the image of God to bear on that person's life. And they said no, and Jesus was angry. Now, just for your curiosity, I thought I would read to you what one of Freud's teachers did in response to the death of his own son. It's a little different response than Jesus' expression of anger. Jesus was free to let his anger out. This was one of Freud's key teachers, and probably a story you've never heard. This man's boy died in his middle 20s. And the author goes on to say, "What degree of violent force against himself and his emotions he needed to build up this front is revealed by this man's reaction to the death of his beloved son. He forbade his family and friends to mention his son's name, put all pictures of him out of sight, and worked even harder than before." That's all I want to read of that. But notice the difference. And certainly that isn't a picture of all of our culture, but that's a synopsis of some of Western culture. This medical professor's son dies, and what does he do? Express his feelings, grieve, process it? No. He represses it, pushes it way down, out of sight, not allowed to be around. Does it go away? No. We all know that. But again, it's important to understand that that's a part of the basis of our European background, is that we push parts of ourselves out of our awareness. That's what Bradshaw means when he talks about your adaptive child. Are you familiar with that phrase? The adaptive child is that part of yourself that as you started to grow up and flex your muscles and your mind and your feelings and explore the world, was told no and that you were bad, and you quickly learned that I get along a whole lot better if I think and feel the way people in power think and feel. And so we began to think and feel like those people. Now that's great in producing conformity. It's not so great in producing creativity. And so if you want to look at the book that we put in the bookstore for you by Stephen Glenn about raising capable children, he's working on a balance between conformity and yet the freedom to embrace our own thoughts and feelings so that we can be creative. Well, let's look briefly at anger and where it comes from in our culture. And I did a little research for you, and the first thing I wanted to start with was the movie The Great Santini. Anybody see that? Okay, Robert Duvall was in it. Let me read a little portion of it. This may sound like your home. This is called The Toughness Harness. And in America and other Western cultures, what we do to boys when they're 17 and 18 is we get them ready to be tough, to work, to do the job of taking care of the family. What we teach women is how to influence men so that they can control that process. And I'm going to be reading from you today about research based on that dynamic. It's not something I'm promoting, just something I'm reporting to you. Okay? It starts out this way, with Duvall addressing his kids. Okay, Hogs, I've listened to you bellyaching about moving to this new town. This said bellyaching will stop as of 15:30 hours and will not affect the morale of the squadron henceforth. Do I make myself clear? I know the kids in unison. Yes, sir. I know it's rough to leave your friends and move every year, but you're Marine kids and can chew nails with the other kids while the other kids are sucking cotton candy. You're Meacham. A Meacham is a thoroughbred, a winner all the way, makes the best grades, wins the best awards, and excels in sports. A Meacham never gives up. I want you, Hogs, to let this bird know you're here. I want these crackers to wake up and wonder what the hell blew into town. Okay, Hogs, by nightfall, I want this camp in inspection order. Do you read me loud and clear? The kids. Yes, sir. Duval, do you read me loud and clear? The kids in unison as the dogs bark. Yes, sir. Duval, outstanding. Does that sound familiar to any of you men as you were raised? Did you have any message like that in your life? Be interested. No pressure to excel, to be the best, to be a Meacham, to carry the flag. If you didn't, I'd be surprised. I grew up in a pretty average town in Portland, and I remember in about the first grade we were building our first home and clearing the land, and we were cutting the trees down with axes and hatchets, and the neighbor had a chainsaw, and I remember asking my dad why we don't go borrow it. And what do you think he told me? Lundy's don't borrow. I own three chainsaws today. I'm never going to be caught without a chainsaw. But you see, it's important for us to understand that the harness is put on boys, now not women, the same harness, but it's put on boys at the end of their high school education, and it's a harness of competitiveness, achievement, winning, and an emotion goes with that that's permissible, and it's the emotion of anger. That to be angry in competition, that to be angry in winning, that to be angry in competing is all right. Now, yesterday, Verlon led us in a discussion of Iron John and some of the male characteristics from our past generations, and I have some information from a recent conference by the American Association of Marriage and Family on the origin of male competitiveness historically. And I wanted to share that with you, again, as a part of getting our discussion going. Right now we're talking in the outline under the cowboy. The cowboy is the male harness. That's the part of ourselves that is like John Wayne. It fights, it, you know, it goes out there and conquers. This is what they were discussing, and I think it's very interesting. David Gilmore, in a book published in 1990 called Manhood in the Making, Cultural Concepts of Masculinity, found this. He found that protecting, providing, and propagating are the main forms of male nurturing and self-sacrifice in almost all cultures. The more dangerous the environment, the more the culture teaches men to be invulnerable, competitive, and aggressive. In dangerous environments, which includes most human environments throughout history, the prized males have been those who would die at a moment's notice to slay big game, navigate dangerous fishing waters, or fight an enemy of the community. Gilmore was surprised at his own conclusion. When I started researching this book, I was prepared to rediscover the old saw that conventional femininity is nurturing and passive, and that masculinity is self-serving, egotistical, and uncaring. But I did not find this. One of my findings here is that manhood ideologies always include a criterion of selfless generosity, even to the point of sacrifice. Again and again, we find that real men are those who give more than they take, serve others, nurture society by shedding their blood, their sweat, bringing home food for both child and mother, by producing children, and by dying if necessary in faraway places to provide a safe haven for their people. This too is nurturing in the sense of endowing or increasing. However, the necessary personal qualities for this male contribution are paradoxically the exact opposite of what we Westerners normally consider the nurturing personality. Any comments or questions about that? I found that very interesting. What he's saying is that the male harness, or the competitiveness, the emotion of anger in part, has come to us historically, culturally, therefore genetically, over a long period of time, and that it's something that we men carry with us, and yet it doesn't fit Western culture very well, where nurturing doesn't need those traits. But we have this within us, this force. Okay, just go ahead.
Well, does that explain then, since we don't need it in, in our day-to-day life, does that explain why we turn it on women or turn it on our children, or is that it's just there and we have to do something with it?
In fact, the next paper presented at this conference, which was in 1990 because the results were published in January 91, says this: when we didn't have any enemy to fight, Western men turned masculinity into a full-time job and practiced it at work and after work and on other people in our cultures. So what they're talking about, I think, is would relate to what you're saying, that since there isn't a real need for us to carry the sword, that we then turn it on others, we join the racquetball club, we never come home, we're very absent, and that was the way they tied that into our culture, that we've turned masculinity into a job instead of understanding masculinity. Well, the interesting thing is, if you follow this idea about men being tough and strong in the male harness, you then look at the other image, the playboy, because the two predominant images for men in America are the cowboy and the playboy. And if you look at the cowboy, you would think that he's a very strong, self-reliant fellow, able to take care of himself. It was really nice. Ruth and her Playworks partner just read part of Leo and Tolstoy and his wife's life story to us. And there was a phrase in there where Leo was talking about just waiting to take his pain back to his wife so that she could nurture it. And the playboy is a bad enough image for men as a simple man who sexualizes himself and sexualizes women. That's a sad enough image. But the playboy, I think, properly understood, is even a sadder image, because it's the image of how dependent men often are on women. And I work a good part of the time in psychiatric hospitals. And you know, one of the leading variables that correlates, not causes, but correlates with male admission to psychiatric units is divorce. And it doesn't correlate with women's admission. It probably solves a lot of women's admission problems. And I'm not joking. Many, many women have to get depressed and exhausted and suicidal before they'll look at a bad marriage and say, maybe I don't belong here. But what we find with men is that the loss of a significant relationship correlates with the breakdown of their self. So let's look briefly then at what I call the playboy, which is really male dependency on women, which also produces a problem in terms of anger because of repression. According to widespread cultural myth, the female is the more dependent one in the man-woman relationship. Clinical experience, however, suggests that this shallowness is simply a self-protective device used by the male to avoid revealing his vulnerability. And listen to these studies now. These were published 10 years ago in a book called The Hazards of Being Male. Recent studies on mental illness, suicide, and death seem to corroborate the theory of profound male dependency on the female and his vulnerability without her. Researchers analyzing numerous studies on the divorced and widowed concluded, when we compare single men with single women, divorced men with divorced women, and widowed men with widowed women, in each case, it is men who are much more likely to be residents of mental hospitals. Data from the National Vital Statistics System indicates that divorced male has an annual death rate that is more than 3 times as high as the divorced female. In one study, researchers found that death, particularly from coronary artery disease, occurred in a group of widowers at 40% above their expected death rates during the 6 months following the death of their wives. So again, male dependency on women. Not that men don't have more power in terms of money or occupational mobility, but that in the home, in their personal lives, right down in the nitty-gritty, men come home and are extremely dependent on their wife. Mm-hmm.
I thought that also there was a theory that men repress their feelings or emotions such that they don't know how to express it. And I thought that the cases that you're saying about men not being able to handle divorce and such, as well as women, was just a matter that they were not able to handle their emotions as well.
That's exactly right. And that those two statements tie together really nicely, because since I can't handle my emotions, who do I have do it for me? My wife. And when you're gone, now I don't have anybody to get mad for me or cry for me or stroke me or nurture me. I don't know how to nurture myself. And so since I have not the skills that women do of expressing emotions, when I lose a wife or a companion or a nurturer, now I'm left with my repression, my split off selves, and those do come back in health damaging ways. Mm-hmm. Good comment. Okay, a couple other pieces of information, and then we're just going to stop and discuss this. You want to take a trip back to when you were adolescent? Okay. By the way, did I tell you women you have to leave for the discussion? Okay. This is from Robert Bly's book, Iron John. I think it's a nice description of adolescence. It's also about male dependency. And just as an aside, in male dependency where women become the nurturer or the surrogate mother, that's not healthy for women either, and I just want to acknowledge that in passing. And he has a section that I'm going to read called The Woman with Golden Hair, and it's about adolescence, and it doesn't mean that the girl's in any better role than the boy. But this is true. This happens all the time. I remember a man telling me of a summer he spent at 15 working as a busboy in a Catskills resort. He and the other boys were doing all right until one day a tall, blonde, beautiful, self-contained, high-cheekboned 16-year-old girl walked into the dining room. It was all over in a moment. The 15-year-old boy sank under the waves. Bubbles came up. He was lost. Her beauty is good enough for the boy's otherworldly longing. Perhaps she even fits some template in their genetic memory. They take one look, and the summer is complete. Then he goes on and talks about adult men. You see, that may be okay if you're 15 or 16, although we would want to look at that because, again, that's a part of how males are socialized to be dependent. We really teach boys that there is a golden-haired girl that will take our pain away. And if you listen to the language of romance, when people fall in love, what do you say to each other? What kind of names do you give each other? Pet names? Nobody's ever loved me like I love you. It's an interesting thing. I do premarital counseling and have the attitude that many folks do, that for young couples fully in romantic love, that premarital counseling is about as worthwhile as watching TV. because the rapture has triggered something from our past. And the interesting thing is that the language of romance is very similar to the language of a mother and a baby. Very similar. Pet names, I'll never leave you, I'll be by your side, I'll love you no matter what, I understand you in ways nobody else does. It's kind of scary. And in fact, probably for folks who fall into romantic love and get married on that basis, they have the full-time job then of learning to know and love that person later in life if they can stay married. Because romantic love has these roots, and we just started reading about it. Now listen to what Robert Bly says to adult men about their emotions. We are looking at the source of a lot of desperation in certain men here and a lot of suffering in certain women. One man may repeat the courting and disappointment over and over. His life had gone like this. He sees a woman across the room, knows immediately that it is she. He drops the relationship he has, pursues her, feels wild excitement, passion, beating heart, obsession. After a few moments, everything collapses. She becomes an ordinary woman. He is confused and puzzled. Then he sees once more a radiant face across the room, and the old certainty comes again. What does it mean when a man falls in love with a radiant face across the room? It may mean that he has some soul work to do. His soul is the issue. Instead of pursuing the woman and trying to get her alone away from her husband, he needs to go alone himself, perhaps to a mountain cabin for 3 months, write poetry, canoe down a river, and dream. That would save some women a lot of trouble. Okay, we have another section in front of you called number 3, Feelings, the Real Male Terror. This is where I want us to turn in discussion format, and I'm just going to open it up to you to talk about this. The reason it's entitled Anger, the Emotion of Men, is because anger is the one emotion as boys are socialized in middle class culture that they're given full permission to have. In sports, in academics, in personal politics, in dating, men can have anger. They can swear, they can storm around, they can drive their cars fast, they can threaten each other, but we don't have the full range of emotions that women do, of sadness and joy and all of those other emotions. We live very differently. I'm not at all saying that we should be like women. And this I would want you to talk about as well. Certainly I believe in equality of the sexes and egalitarian marriages. I have no problem with women having any job, role, or position that any man does. But I do believe that there are probably some differences at this point. And even this recent conference on marriage and family was highlighting some of those genetic differences. But what we're talking about is that as young boys grow up and develop their self-awareness, that thoughts certainly are focused on a lot, but that feelings get repressed. The one feeling that's left in our conscious awareness is anger, and that a whole other set of feelings gets split off in our identity, and that creates a lot of problems for us. We were discussing last night.
That was generic?
Genetic? This is cultural, this process, but I do believe in genetic differences in terms of our own emotional awareness and our processing. For instance, neurologically, this is just a bit of genetic stuff. Neurologically, boys have learning disabilities 4 times as often as girls. So that's biological. Boys are born with a less intact learning system than girls are. And that's just something that's given to them biologically. Boys are more hyperactive. We have more hyperkinetic energy than girls. There are hyperactive girls. Maybe one of you, I made that statement in a group not too long ago, and the lady jumped up and said, "Oh, I have a hyperactive girl." Believe me, that's right. There are hyperactive girls. But boys, way, way more than girls, have hyperkinetic problems, hyperactivity. Those are genetic differences that also have emotional consequences, because hyperactive people feel a lot more intense. Okay, what are some of your thoughts and reactions to this about the emotional life of men? And that's what we're really talking about. So guys and women, I'm just going to give you the floor for a while and pick up our discussion of last night or wherever you would like to go.
I wonder if I'm unique in this way. I don't think I am, but I tend to show anger more when there's nobody around than when there is somebody around. Because I want to get to see that vulnerability, that explosion of emotion in that. So I get angry much more, and I swear more, and I hit things more, and throw things more when nobody's looking.
Mm-hmm. That's probably why in marriages, the first honeymoon is over, they begin to show anger. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who say, "Well, I didn't know you were angry." Mm-hmm. It suddenly comes out like a volcano.
There's, I'm tempted to talk too much about this, but you're very right. What's the, moms, what's one of the earliest emotions of your kids? Moms know this more than dads. Anger, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because as the child discovers that you're not just going to nurture them all the time, which is the romance, they get ticked. Okay? Now, if my marriage has a romantic flair to it, that reminds me of some past really good time, and romance is where we're both putting in the same bucket. What happens after the marriage contract? And do you know that living together has absolutely no prediction power for divorce, for marital success? None. There's absolutely no better marital success rate than to live together before you got married. And why? Because when you're living together, you're still both putting in the bucket. You say, "I do." And you do what every other honest person in the world ever did. You said, "Well, I got married to see what I could get out of this." But your spouse is saying the same thing. And when you both reach for the bucket, anger is that next emotion. It was also one of our first awarenesses as a human being.
Also culturally, too, if you're a job you don't like, or if you're under pressure, where do you vent that anger? Mm-hmm. You have to get someone, you vent it against someone you assume loves you will never leave you. Mm-hmm. So the spouse, once again, becomes the victim of that.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask you a question when you're through with this?
We're just letting people talk. So
my question is this sequestering of all emotions, essentially, but anger that you're talking about, found in West European culture currently? In West European culture, which is the main source, though not the only source, of our American culture. Now, how about other cultures around the world? Is this sequestering not found there?
Boy, you know, I am just not confident in cross-cultural comments. All I can tell you from my work as a day-to-day psychologist is that the feeling movement has started as a therapy movement. Conscious, full of information. That Bradshaw is our current spokesman of get in touch with your feelings and celebrate your inner child. Bradshaw's information comes from people like Alice Miller, who's a European Jungian analyst, and from people like Robert Bly. If you listen to Bradshaw talk, he says that one of his spiritual fathers was Robert Bly, and one of his intellectual fathers or mothers was Alice Miller. European, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want, with regard to anger, I had a father, my real father, mm-hmm. that was probably, that killed him, mm-hmm. I mean, at a very young age, and he was a wild man. But if people didn't know him, he's a fantastic person, but the ones that really knew him, he was just, he had a temper that was, I mean, it caused a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I've had to fight this repression of myself all my life. I haven't done too good a job, but I'm way, well, I'm 70, so I made it past the 50s anyway. But it's been a real battle for me. It is a battle all the time. I've got a real quick fuse on some things. Yeah. But, you know.
Here and then back to the line.
What you talk about is something that I think is... really is real strong, is that I think that the modeling that we observe in our families, particularly families of origin, have a substantial, or have a lot to do with the, our ability to be angry, to appropriately express the anger, because we do, as children, we learn that very, I mean, it's like empathy, it's one of the few things that you learn best and the most when you're real small, because it's one of the first things that we do learn. The other thing is that within marriages, oftentimes that's a cross current that really affects. You know, if one of the spouses comes from a family where anger is quickly and easily expressed, and another one where it's always repressed or whatever, and they get married. The issues around anger become the central point of the marriage. It doesn't have to destroy it, but it certainly is one of the things that has to be dealt with first in order for that marriage, as soon as the romantic love kind of dissipates. But certainly that environment, the environment is where we learn, I think, the most about what to do with our anger.
I would agree. Can you bet?
It seems to go back to what you were meaning earlier. Men make a good living because of our anger. You know, if we're not angry, we don't make money. You know, and we don't support our families. And I mean, people aren't paying what Robert Bly calls soft male. You know, you can't live in the corporate world being a loving male. You don't climb the ladder. You don't make it in business. Being a loving male, it seems the best you can do is to work for somebody else, you know. But at the same time, and then on the other hand, women aren't attracted to men unless men earn money. You know, that's part of it too. So it's kind of like you're hold on. So it's kind of like on the one hand, society rewards you financially if you're an angry man. And then you're supposed to be able to come home and turn it off and be loving. That seems to be the trick or the problem. It can't be done. Or isn't done well.
And if you're interested in that, you might read The Hazards of Being Male, because it's a book that documents how men have to deal with the price of being that angry to be that successful, and the way that... You know, who gets blamed when kids go awry in a corporate family? Well, Dad. He was never there, he had no emotions, and he drank too much. Well, why did he drink every day? Because there was a lot of pain, and he was medicating himself. And I'm not excusing him. And why was he gone? Because you've got to pay that price to earn the money. And that's how he attracted that family and kept them together. But if we do that, we end up paying the price and getting the blame. And that is the, you know, you're really focusing the right issues for us. Because how are we going to deal as men with our emotional selves, our some of our genetic past, our natural competitiveness, if you will? And how are we going to fit into this world and make a good place for ourselves?
Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of thoughts, and maybe I'll just throw these out. And the first is that I've been struck recently by what, to me, is the reality that a lot of the things that society and maybe much of the world is feeling very important right now, peace, harmony, cooperation, love, forgiveness, among people and among peoples and among nations, are predominantly feminine-associated states of mind or emotions. And that we are continually, in the last several decades, downplaying things that are traditionally male-associated, such as war, aggression, dominance, maybe even competition. And that may be one reason why it might be very important to get a handle on finding ways for men to have access to other emotions besides anger and their associated aggression, dominance, and competition, is that if we are to achieve peace and harmony and avoid war, which is so incredibly destructive now because of our new technologies, we need to be able to get the male as well as the female mentality tracking in this direction, perhaps as well as sharing power in multiple ways with females.
Of course, it's not the anger that's wrong, it's how it's against it. Anger is an emotion that can be put into very positive effect.
Oh, absolutely.
Some of the very fine people I know, our leaders, are, if they're angry, it doesn't come out that it comes out being firm, standing up for what's right. So I think we're trying to say that anger here, we can have it, and then we don't have the emotion that sometimes drives us to do our best.
Oh, I very much want to say we want anger. We very much want anger. We don't want it to be the only emotion, but we very much want to have anger, a kind of anger that says, I have a problem right now here or with you, or I have a concern. I'm going to use my anger as an opportunity to clarify this. Conflict is an opportunity. Anger is a good emotion. If it's the only emotion and we repress our others, we're crazy angry. And that's what men are always getting a bad rap for, is being crazy angry, running people off freeways. You know, folks, really successful corporate businessmen getting their BMWs and act like street kids. And that's repressed anger. They come tell me about it. I know what happens.
I think I see Jesus being angry very often. But anger comes
right
across in humor. When you read some of the things he said, they were very... it was an anger that was used in a constructive way. So I think it's safe. You can laugh something off. There are many ways to deal with it.
The absolute number one thing we're talking about is not repressing emotions, anger, or any other one. You and then we'll go back to the
model. What I get, what you're saying, and is that men, in repressing, they all their emotions get channeled as anger. I'm really feeling sad, but I'm not supposed to cry, so I'll swear and hit somebody.
Right.
I'm not supposed to feel lonely, so I'll get angry instead. And that, you know, I still see people telling their little boys don't cry, and I just want to go shake them. Yes, little boys can cry.
Yeah, the example of the professor that I read who forbade anyone to mention his boy's name after he died was then known as the toughest professor. Now, it wasn't really anger the emotion he needed to deal with, it was grief. But since he never dealt with his grief, he was an angry professor.
Well, it seems like our whole society, even though we talk about anger being... in charge of our anger. We live very well because of our anger with the whole war and everything. You know, the fact that America will go to war for something means that there are people who we can tell to get angry. And they'll go use their anger. And we live very well, you know, because of the anger of the people we elect as our chief officers and that sort of thing. But a question I have is, or their models. Someone over here mentioned humor. I know comedians are generally not very happy people. I've read things about comedians that in general, they're not fun-loving people. They're really kind of angry, bitter people. Are there models of people who use their anger well, men that we can point to?
I don't know about a man or a model. The book that I brought, The Dance of Intimacy, and this is a feminist book, so it's always about women. It's also about men. This is a book about anger and about different ways of processing it. And she has a book called The Dance of Anger. I think this is an even better book that talks about how we must do our own personal work before we can handle our emotions. And this is why women are important in this discussion. You're being silent, and that's fine, but if you want to jump in, feel free. As long as women allow men to be dependent on them, which is a position of power to some degree, men don't grow up. And I have a lot of men in their 40s who tell me, you know, I finally grew up this year. I learned I could take care of myself, I could nurture myself after a setback in business or a hurt or a personal loss. They say this between 40 and 50. And they tell me they're freer and happier than they've ever been. They need their wife less and love her more, because they're not in that dependent relationship anymore. But maybe we could just do a little survey on your question about do we get rewarded for anger? Men might want to be willing to raise their hand. If anger in your workplace is permissible for you, and when you express it, if it occasionally gets you a payoff, would that be? Is that, you want to vote? Is that true for you, men? Or not?
No.
What's the question?
Is anger for you in your workplace permissible? And if you choose to be angry, does it get you a payoff?
At least for me, that the anger is often something someone else mentioned in here. It could be a driver.
Mm-hmm.
Getting angry, at least in my work, will get me in trouble.
Okay.
But getting angry in a way and channeling that anger to look for solutions and to find a solution to the problem or the thing that's making me angry, then there's the payoff. But the anger itself, just the expression of anger, would not.
Well, that may be pretty productive anger if it's an energizer, as long as it's a legitimate issue and it's not overdriving. We're talking about just the expression of anger. It's very permissible where I work, and it has immediate, positive, direct payoff. It's okay. What about you women? Is it okay to get angry where you work? Any woman?
I work at home, and it's not worth it to get angry. Yes, people take you more seriously sometimes.
Okay.
That's true.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. An example of payoff in anger is my wife, when she returns some paint that doesn't work, she's very kind,
mm-hmm.
and he'll say, you pay for it. I walk in and say, I want my money back, it's lousy.
Mm-hmm.
They'll pay right away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's anger or being firm.
It's firm.
There's a close connection there. But you get rewards that way. Mm-hmm.
Are we paying anger with aggression?
Sometimes. And I think Verlon was. Yeah.
What's that again?
She was asking if we were equating anger with aggression. Yeah. Clearly, anger can be productive and it can be an energizer. It can be a good response. One of the healthiest responses to anger is I have a bad experience and I'd say to myself, no way, no way. I'm not going to find myself here again. And I turn and use that anger creatively, productively, problem solving wise.
When you say that the American man is raised
mm-hmm.
to feel that it's okay to be angry, are you talking about an emotional outburst?
Occasionally, and that if he's going to have an emotional outburst, it better be anger. It better not be collapsing in tears or starting to sing in the middle of his work day or stopping to smell the flowers or any of the other huge host of emotions. That the predominant permissible emotion, the one that you're not going to get a lot of penalty for, You know, they might say, cool off, don't swear that way. Man, can't you drive a little less? But it won't have negative long-term repercussions, typically, if a man gets angry. That's what I'm suggesting.
Emotionally aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not agreeing with it, but I'm suggesting that's the...
I'd like to clarify one thing. My personal experience has been that I've experienced fear, I've experienced joy, I've experienced love, I've experienced fear again, I've experienced confusion, I've experienced anger. You know, I've had a lot of feelings in my life. Are you saying that I haven't had all those feelings?
No.
Yeah. It's that I'm only encouraged to or approved of when I express anger.
Right. And we saw a shift of that in this last war, which we know that the military sent personnel to the front lines to let boys talk about being afraid to die. And that was a new thing. Now, pro or con what you feel about that whole business, America has decided that young soldiers can be afraid. But that's a new thing. Those emotions you experience are wonderful, and the fact that you're aware of them is good evidence about who you are. But many, many men tell me, you know, at my mother's funeral, I had to make sure that somebody didn't cry, and I elected to be that person. Mm-hmm. Or in the face of financial difficulties, well, they've just been taught that. You know, that's what a 50-year-old real estate broker told me that last week. He was talking about his mother's funeral, and that he felt this in his American male model was the best gift he could give his family at his mother's death. Mm-hmm. Was
at my mother's death, there were 7 brothers, and they all cried.
That's a lot better. That's the way it's supposed to be, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. This man is. You know, he's got all kinds of nervous disorders. He should have resigned his business years ago, but there's no awareness of his feelings, so he just keeps pushing on.
How much does the lack of the ability to express the anger have to do with just not having the vocabulary or the words? And I know that particularly in arguments with my wife, that I'm bested in terms of her verbal ability, and I find myself pulling back into a place that I basically withdraw from expression of any emotion. I mean, I find myself buffering there, and you know, I react differently, so that what'll happen is 2 days later, it'll finally have chunk through, where I will have some response to something that her ability to connect with those feelings and find words for those feelings.
Do we have a woman that has the exact same experience, that your husband's faster with words than you are?
Yeah.
And you feel, you have the same experience?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. The reason that's important is to be clear that that's not a male-female difference, although we anecdotally think it is. The ability to put thoughts into words is a form of intelligence, one of maybe 7 different forms of intelligence. It occurs in men and women, and it's not just women who are good at that. Some women aren't good at it, and that's okay. If you're one of the people that thinks a while longer before you formulate, you've got to learn a way to get your space. Because if people press on you before you've got your words ready to reflect your inner self, you'll feel violated. And after a while, you can really get ticked off, because it's the timing is never fair for you. The other person's always ready to go, and you're not ready to go. And that's exactly right. But it happens for women just as often as for men. Now, we're not just talking about repressed anger. What we're really talking about is, as young boys grow up, we repress all of our emotions except anger. That we repress fear, sadness, joy, and other emotions like that. And that we're reinforced for repressing those, and that we get paid well by expressing anger. And then what happens, these become a fuel source that then blasts our anger into outer space. And just as you were saying, some of the nicest men that you and I know create terror in their homes. When what they need to do is deal with their fear, their sadness, their dreams, their hopes, their hurts, but we don't do that. So these are the split off parts of ourselves, the parts that we need to re-embrace, that we need to bring back into ourselves, and then find words for all of our emotions so I can talk about my disappointment, my sadness, my hurts, my ideals, my, you know, whatever. And it's a very hard process because it's about revealing who I am to you. And this can get just really efficient to just be brusque and angry and busy and have no emotions.
I think that the new generation of women coming up that have heavy careers are starting to do the very same thing that men are doing. They're starting to repress the fear and the joy because they can't get far in their job if they do show those emotions like women.
I can't say I know that for sure, but it sure makes sense.
I've seen it a lot. You know, they act more like men because they have to get their jobs. They're men for men's jobs, and that's the only way they can get them.
Are we making, is there much afoot in American culture to change the situation we've been discussing? For how long? And what is perhaps your thought, or anyone's thought, about its chances for significant success in the future?
I've observed a real small thing that's kind of been shocking to me, and that is, I work with people and we go on a trip and we lay over somewhere in a hotel for a good day and then come back the next day. And I've observed a real phenomena there that people go to workout rooms in hotels and get on these stair climbers. And they try to outdo each other in on these machines, like a life cycle or something like that. And that's how they spend the layover. Next day they go back home. Now in my mind, you know, you gotta go to the museum or the art museum or something like that.
That's the macho part.
This is the last 5 years. And it just just baffles me. And how can you work all day and then get to the hotel and go to that room?
I don't have any concrete response to that, but one thing that's pretty well documented is that hardworking American businessmen used to drink as a way to deal with all that. That the martini lunch was not just a way to spend company money, it was a way to keep emotions repressed. And as people are drinking less, I think we're seeing them turn to other forms of processing pent-up emotions.
It's like if men didn't repress, if we didn't repress all of those other emotions and we let them out, that the whole scope of marriage and society as we know it would change tremendously. And it just seems like, you know, nobody's ready for that. You know, I'm not sure if the world could handle it. I mean, if our society could handle it, because things are set up for this model. And the moment, it's kind of like what you were talking about the other day, like for change. The moment people really start changing in that direction, then it's kind of, you start running into walls, you know, because there's no place for it.
I think there's a lot of models about change, and the clearest one that I could give you that summarizes it all would be Bradshaw's work. His book about the family and guilt and shame, and his recent book Homecoming, talk about, for men and women, creating a family world that allows us to think and feel, grow and become who we are, and to embrace our entire self. And if you've seen Bradshaw, he's not a soft male, and I think that is an important idea, that we're not talking about men becoming like women. I don't believe in unisexism in terms of personality theory. I think we have different genetics. But certainly, men have to learn to think and feel as well as women. The final thing I would suggest is that Robert Bly is talking about one of the solutions is that men learn to be dependent on men instead of women. And Herb Goldbrook, in his book 10 years ago called The Hazards of Being Male, said men must recover the lost art of buddyship, where we can learn to be vulnerable man to man so that we aren't as dependent on women, and then we will finish growing up and we'll be better fathers, husbands, and better humans. Well, we're out of time. Thank you very much, and keep the discussion going.
I'm going to go to the next one.